This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. Most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
I'm Rick Dalton. It's my pleasure, Mr. Schwartz.
Call me Marvin. Put it there. That your son?
No, it's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
Last night, we watched a Rick Dalton double feature. All the shooting. I love that stuff, you know, the killing.
A lot of killing.
Anybody order fried sauerkraut? Burn you Nazi bastards!
Once upon a time, in Hollywood, is the new and ninth film from Quentin Tarantino. He says he's only going to make 10, so take what you can get at this point. But this is Quentin Tarantino's quote-unquote love letter to 1960s Hollywood, 1969 in particular, which is kind of seen as a bit of an end of an era. The start of a new Hollywood movement, literally the new Hollywood movement, where films like Easy Rider and ultimately, you know, The Godfathers and all those kind of great films of the 70s would emerge. But it was the sort of end of a cultural era in the United States as well. Tarantino takes us through this story with two fictional characters, the first being Rick Dalton, who is a fading star played by Leonardo DiCaprio. He used to have his own TV show where he was a Western sort of a sheriff. He had the gall to try and make it as a movie star, and he was comically punished by Hollywood and now is left doing guest appearances on a variety of forgotten Westerns and cop shows. And he has to face the indignity of now being a day player when he used to be the main star. Now, because he doesn't have that much work anymore, that means there's not enough work for his best buddy, stunt double Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt. I mean, look, Brad Pitt, he's got a great body still. I'm a bit dubious that at 52, or whatever age he is, 50, he'd still be able to make it as a working stuntman. I don't know what the age limits are in Hollywood today. Nonetheless, he basically works as Rick's driver these days, and his primary job seems to be boosting Rick's ego and validating him at every turn before he can kind of throw in the towel. And largely, this movie is a really fun, sweet buddy comedy about these two guys just trying to make it when their careers are definitely on the decline. And it's also a very novel satire, behind-the-scenes satire of how they used to make movies and how they used to make TV shows. And obviously, these eras, well, this era is of keen interest to Quentin Tarantino. He's always hinted at it, even as early as Reservoir Dogs. And you think, well, here he's just in his playroom, in his toy box, just recreating these old shows and literally restaging scenes from The Great Escape and other real-life Westerns and cop shows and integrating Leonardo DiCaprio and having them meet Bruce Lee and all these other kind of iconic figures of the time. So that's all very fun and enjoyable. But this movie is 3 hours long, and for good reason, well, for a reason, I should say, because it does eventually dovetail with real life, because where should Rick Dalton live but on Cielo Drive, just down the driveway from Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate, who are, of course, real-life figures. And Sharon Tate, in particular, played here by Margot Robbie, has become defined, tragically, by the way in which she was murdered along with several of her friends, because in 1969, in fact, on August 8th, which is 50 years ago yesterday, the Manson family descended on their home and basically committed one of the most vicious murder sprees in known history. And so that is what the film is building to. You know, there is a ticking clock on this movie as we begin in February of 1969, move to August 8th, and literally we move from, you know, the morning to the afternoon to midnight, and the clock truly is ticking on Tate and those around her. And you're just wondering, how will this all intersect? And of course, inevitably, it does. And I won't get into the details of that. But I have to admit to you both, when this movie ended, the first question I had on my mind was, why did Quentin Tarantino make this? Why has he made this goofy comedy that does indeed dovetail with this horrendous real-life tragedy, this real incident that is just horrific to read about? And I don't know that I've arrived at an answer. I mean, just, you know, how do you guys feel when you hear that this fluffy behind-the-scenes comedy does kind of take a bit of the historical record and insert it violently?
I have to admit, when you emailed through saying we were going to talk about this film, maybe a week or so before, I hadn't heard anything about it.
Right.
It just sort of was like, oh, this is coming to Australia and it's going to pop up. And I was like, oh, why haven't I been paying attention and why haven't I heard anything about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood before, like, maybe 2 weeks ago? And so then seeing the cast and seeing who's in it and the characters, and it was a bit like, okay, maybe that's what it'll be about. I don't really know. And then to hear how it does intersect, yeah, I'm a little bit confused. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Tristan, what are your fears and concerns?
Well, it's I haven't seen this yet. I'm dying to see it. I am a Quentin Tarantino fan, despite, you know, all the areas in which he is problematic. But, you know, when it was announced, I think people were kind of... and, you know, it has come back in the culture, a lot of interest in the Manson family. And I recommend the podcast You Must Remember This. The Carina Longworth podcast does a whole series about that and takes a lot of perspectives and really does kind of give you the sense of that era. And I think people were excited about, well, Quentin Tarantino's going to focus on this and kind of look at that. But it seems to be that it's mainly in the background, and there are kind of key moments that people who have know a little bit about it will kind of go, this is that area, this is these characters. And but I think from what I'm getting is that maybe people were thinking that with this film, Quentin Tarantino was going to get, like, serious, whereas I think that he has made it a Quentin Tarantino film and kind of taken this thing and kind of made it into a genre thing, is the impression I'm getting.
Yeah, look, yes and no, right? Yeah. And because it is unmistakably a Quentin Tarantino film. If you're a fan of his movies, and especially, you know, even his fluffier genre ones, I think you're going to get a kick out of it. I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it. I feel I can confidently say it's the least of his films. You know, I would rank it ninth overall, even below Death Proof, which I do really like Death Proof. That's not a backhanded compliment. But that said, there is more melancholy to this movie than people may anticipate. Mm. It is a really strange and sad kind of drama at times. And yes, it has its genre moments. And ultimately, what I think he's trying to do here is almost poke a bit of a hole in Quentin Tarantino, or even in this era that he loved, because it is about the phoniness of Hollywood. It is about the fakeness of what goes into making a movie. We literally see, you know, Rick Dalton shooting and flubbing his lines and having to retake and having a breakdown in his trailer. And I think ultimately it is about that fakeness of movies, and we love them and we rely on them, and sometimes for comfort, but the horrors of the real world are really just always flirting at the fringes. So that's interesting. I don't know that it all congeals entirely. I've been sitting on this for a week. I need more time. I'm glad you're going to both see it next week so we can dig into it some more. I'll be very keen to hear what people think about this movie. Certainly in Australia, where we're a bit more removed from, I guess, you know, the Californian, you know, a lot of critics are based in LA. We hear a lot of their perspectives. They're probably too close to it, I think.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Like, this film has received a lot of different controversies, but one that's blown up more than probably anticipated has been the treatment of Bruce Lee, which I'm sure is only like he features only in a short scene. But, like, you know, his daughter, who's in charge of the foundation, came out and was very disappointed with the kind of the caricature made of his father. And there have been different critics and different perspectives from particularly Asian American critics about his treatment. How did you feel about the way he came off in this
film? The Bruce Lee scene is actually one of the weakest scenes in the movie. Again, I won't go into the spoilers there, but he is definitely played for comic effect, and that didn't really sit totally well with me, especially because, I mean, the racial element aside, it's sort of a caricature, and it's probably, it is, you know, offensive. But more so, it's just like, well, Bruce Lee is this great fighter. He's this great athlete, and he's kind of diminished in this movie. And it's like, well, why would you do that? That doesn't even make like logical sense. The other big controversy is about Margot Robbie's role in this as Sharon Tate and how little dialogue she has in the film. That one doesn't hold as much water to me. I think she gives the best performance in this, and I think Sharon Tate is given an inner life, and she has a really fantastic sequence, which, yes, she doesn't have a lot of dialogue in, but it is this, you know, 10-15 minute scene where we kind of live with her, and it is the reason Once Upon a Time in Hollywood works. It's that strangeness, that sadness, knowing what is awaiting Sharon Tate in real life. So look, you got to say it. It's Quentin Tarantino. He's only got one film after this, apparently. But I think people will wrestle with this one more than maybe any of his other movies.
I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
to
do it.
I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
What do you think? It's like another world. Tomorrow's a big day.
Is it scary?
What is it?
It has special properties.
What am I going through?
We just need to acclimate.
I don't want to acclimate. I want to go.
Absolutely not.
What's happening?
Midsommar is a long movie, but I saw it last night. It didn't feel long to me, and that's a good sign. But it's also the second film from Ari Aster, who made, I can't even think, Hereditary. Why is it blanking? But anyway, Hereditary, which I remember, you know, it was only the other year. You can watch it on Netflix. It was a film I was very excited to see. And when I saw it, it had a lot of power, but it was also quite dark, a bit of a bummer, and it had an ending that I found more quizzical than satisfying. Did you see Hereditary?
This is one that I've really put off just because of people's like feedback from it.
Yeah, it is a very upsetting movie. Great. And it's hard to recommend that, even though I do, and I think Tristan does as well.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, he's working in the horror genre, but he is also pulling references from art house directors like Ingmar Bergman and Peter Greenaway. So there is something a bit more artful about his films than maybe some more kind of trashy horror films. And this film, Midsommar, does follow in the tradition of his first film. But for me, I found it a bit more satisfying, and I'll get to that in a moment. But what is the plot of Midsommar? Well, basically, there's a lot of Wicker Man vibes. There's a lot of culty vibes. Basically, we open with a couple. I'm trying to think of the character's name. Danny, played by Florence Pugh, up-and-comer is probably, that was 3 years ago when she was in the critically acclaimed Lady Macbeth, but she's gone from strength to strength in her career in terms of films like Fighting With My Family, which Simon reviewed favorably, and also she's been cast in the upcoming Black Widow Marvel movie. So, you know, once you're in a Marvel movie, your career's in a lot. But yeah, she is a great actor, and so she is the lead in this, and is a woman going through a real personal maelstrom of just intense emotions and depression due to a family tragedy. The problem is this is happening while she and her long-term partner, Christian, played by Jack Rayner, are kind of on the downslide of their relationship. It's been a couple of years and it looks like they're kind of on the way out. But, I think at the start, he is about to kind of try and pull the trigger, but this tragedy happens and, you know, it's a bit like a Seinfeld routine. He can't just, like, break up with her when all this is happening. The problem is he's already organized with his buddies to go to Sweden for a holiday and has not told her. So to kind of, you know, get over that massive gap in communication, invites her along as a kind of a second a chance thought. And his friends include William Jackson Harper from The Good Place, kind of playing a similar cheaty nerd character. There's also Will Poulter, who plays Mark, and he carries a vape stick with him and is... That's one side of his very aggravating, terrible character. And then also Pele, played by Wilhelm Bolgren, who he's taking them to a festival, to a community that he grew up in. And so they're all just like looking forward to the kind of the bright skies, the fact that the sun never goes down at night. And they are taken to this place where everyone is wearing kind of white linen, smiling very effusively, doing kind of strange rituals and interesting dancing, and a lot of and, you know, welcoming them to a 9-day festival. And anyone who knows going in knows that something bad is going to happen. And a lot of bad things do. But Asta, as a director and a writer, really is effective at playing with expectations and really drawing out the anxiety-raising kind of, you know, cues of what's going on, that's strange, that's weird, what's happening, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And it really does, you know, this is a very violent film. There's some very graphic body horror in it. And I don't want to spoil anything else about the film, but it's also, I went with my partner who does not like horror films at all and was very nervous about seeing this film, worried that it was going to give her nightmares. But at the end, she loved it. There was something very satisfying about this film, and it comes down to the performances, the artistic way that everything is delivered, and the fact that even though it's kind of a horror film, it's also a relationship movie and is looking at this breakdown of this couple, and the fact that the boyfriend is such a dickhead. he's like you just can't wait to see what is going to transpire. And so there is something, I think, a bit more satisfying for the viewer than for me anyway. I preferred it over Hereditary. But yeah, this is, I mean, I went last night with a packed audience. It was the opening night at Luna, and everyone had a great time because, you know, this film is full on, but there's also, it is quite funny as well. Not in a very like a tongue-in-cheek way, but just like in a darkly comedic way that people really got into. So look, I really enjoyed Midsommar. Simon, you've seen this as well. What was your take on this ride?
Yeah, and it is a ride, and you got to be down for it.
Yes.
And that's the thing. And Taylor, I know you haven't seen Hereditary. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the trailer for Midsommar at all?
I have.
Yeah. When you watch that, do you go, okay, I kind of know what I'm in for and I'm into that, or are you a bit putting it at arm's reach?
No, I know that I'm into it and I do want to see this film. I don't know if I do know what I'm in for, you know?
And I think that's really important. And the best thing I can say to listeners is the real test is to watch Hereditary first. And if you like that movie, or if you enjoy is the wrong word for it, but if you don't mind getting sucked into that world and get something out of it, then you will be ready, I think, for Midsommar. The woman behind me in the screening that I went to clearly did not know Hereditary, fell asleep very early on, woke up at the most horrendously violent scene, and then stormed out of the cinema, calling it a stupid movie, and that was quite fun. And that is part of the fun of Midsommar, not that people will call it stupid, but that it is a real, it's a challenge, but I think a rewarding one. Mm. And Florence Pugh is fantastic in it. I really enjoyed Jack Rayner as well, who is, you know, this total scrub, also known as a buster, of a boyfriend. And the rest of the performers are great. But truly what you're going for is this incredible, and we should say the movie takes almost entirely place during the daytime because in this particular Swedish community, the sun effectively doesn't set. You're going for that slow and steady build up to just absolute emotional, psychological, and physical, you know, violence that it really does pay off in a spectacular way. So yeah, you really need a strong stomach, both for the emotional trauma and the physical trauma of the movie. But if you're down for it, I think it's pretty rewarding.
Because it's a very, like, much like Hereditary, he is interested in sounds, in, like, gasps, in the ways in which people just, like, go for it in terms of crying and letting out their emotions. Mm. So it is a real, like, it's a testament to the actors because they're going through a lot, just in terms of exerting themselves, but also just in the film. And, yeah, the costume design, the cinematography, the music, all of that is excellent as well, and working towards this this feeling and this uneasy feeling. But yeah, it's definitely, it's R-rated, which doesn't happen. It doesn't feel like it doesn't happen that much at the Australian cinemas anymore. So it's R-rated for a reason, and yeah, you got to be, I think, willing to go on the ride. And his work is also, you know, there's further discussions about elevated genre, and maybe people who love horror might feel like, oh my God, this is taking too long and this is too, like, artistic for me or something like that. So, you know, look, I thought it was, yeah, really good, and I found it a bit more satisfying than Hereditary. And, you know, he says that his next films are not essentially going to be horror, so he might be moving away from the genre. So, and A24, who are marketing it, have done a great job in making sure everyone kind of knows about it. So, yeah, look, go in, but if you go in a little bit informed or know that this is going to be a full-on experience.
Pick a door. All right, then.
No, that's my door. Pick another door.
What's wrong with you? You know what? You were right. This is your door.
What's the matter? You got a lot of bad guys behind that door?
We're going to talk about is a spin-off to a franchise that you've not seen any of the films to.
No, we did talk about this on email yesterday. It is The Fast and the Furious.
Yes.
And I worked out this is the 8th film?
Well, that's the thing. It's a spin-off, but it's technically the 9th.
So if I wanted to be up to speed to get this one, I worked out if I started watching them last night and I stayed up all afternoon and all night, I wouldn't have made it through.
No. And you know, some of the later movies in particular get into the over the two-hour mark. So, yeah, you would definitely be stretching things.
This is why I haven't seen any of those Marvel movies. Yeah. There's just too many now to catch up. It's like I left it too late.
Yeah. Too many and too long. Well, that's the thing. This film is a spin-off to the Fast and the Furious franchise, which in the first movie started off as a kind of, it was a little bit like Point Break, but with cars. It was based on a magazine article about the kind of the life of street racing, and was about an undercover cop played by Paul Walker who got into this lifestyle and community in order to find a gang of car thieves. But as the movies have gone on, they've really developed into a global blockbuster kind of franchise that has meant that this crew of LA-based car thieves have become international agents of mystery.
Because that's how that happens.
That's it, yeah. And they keep adding new people to the franchise. It keeps expanding. And, you know, a couple of cast members that were added in Fast 5, we had Dwayne Johnson, who plays Hobbs, who was a kind of unrelenting officer of the law who was after Toretto and his gang, Toretto being the character played by Vin Diesel. And then we had Shaw, played by Jason Statham, who started off as a villain, but in the classic way of, I guess, comic books, has become a hero and a bit of an anti-hero. But so they were partnered together in the last Fast and the Furious movie, Fate of the Furious, and now they have their own spin-off. So, yeah.
It must be hard just to come up with the new names for it, rather than the 9th one.
That's it. And so for this one, they've just gone with Fast and the Furious, Hobbs and Shaw. So this is the kind of the launching pad of potentially another spin-off franchise from the Fast and the Furious universe.
Are we allowed to call him Dwayne Johnson now? Do we know who he is? We don't have to...
Well, that's the thing.
We don't have to say Dwayne The Rock.
No.
Johnson. We know him now.
That's it. I think so. Like, it started off, he was The Rock, and then he, I think, was trying to move away from his persona as a wrestler.
He's reached full Mellencamp status, is what we're saying.
That's it. But even in this film, he still kind of has a throwback wink to his wrestling moves of old, particularly the eyebrow raise. So, yeah, he is Dwayne Johnson. I mean, they're two, you know, big actors, and this is a big movie in that it's an action buddy comedy. It's a lot of noise. It's a real turn off your brain situation because it does play very fast and loose with the laws of physics in a lot of sequences. But it's basically about these two guys who are mismatched. They don't get along. One's from America, one's from Britain, one's kind of a pint down at the pub kind of guy, which is Jason Statham, and the other is a kind of weights in the gym guy, which is Dwayne Johnson.
How do they line up to, you know, your classic duos of the screen? Are they as good as, you know, Starsky and Hutch or Dempsey and Makepeace?
Well, that's a good question. They definitely have what is basically a kind of, that tense relationship, in that it's a lot of kind of insults thrown at each other. They spend most of the time kind of making fun of each other, and it's interesting because this is a film that's supposed to kind of play to general audiences, and in another time some of the dialogue would have been a bit more filthier and wrong, but here the taunts that they have for each other are kind of like something out of a joke book for 5-year-olds or something. It's all about, and it's a lot of also macho penis swinging, we should say. I mean, it's all about, it really gets into a lot of kind of like, you're not man enough, you're not masculine enough, blah, blah, blah. But you know, it's a buddy duo that soon becomes a real friendship due to the fact that they have to save Shaw's sister, who is an agent on the run, and she's played by Vanessa Kirby, which my partner Sally was very excited about because Vanessa Kirby plays Princess Margaret in The Crown.
Know. You know?
And so she was already...
She's fabulous.
She's awesome. And she was already in the last Mission Impossible movie, so she's getting out there, out of the kind of the period drama into some of these action movies, and she's great. Sally had a lot to say about her eyeliner and the way that it's maintained through all the action sequences. But she has, you know, look, I could get into the details of the plot, but it really doesn't matter. It's all a MacGuffin. She has this virus that could destroy the world. She's on the run. She needs the help of her brother and Dwayne Johnson. And they're on the run from another big star, Idris Elba, who plays the villain. He plays the bad guy.
Ooh. You know, it's interesting when people, they're a little bit into their career and they're still willing to take on villain roles. Because I feel like if you become a bit famous, you kind of turn down the villain roles. Unless you are... you know, Malcolm McDowell, and that's just what you do.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Like, you know, he would totally be the hero of his own franchise, and maybe for the fact that I think the majority of the film is shot in London, so they grab a lot of kind of, like, British actors, and this would, you know, do well for his profile. But, yeah, he basically plays a kind of a cyber-enhanced, genetically modified bad guy who wears a bulletproof outfit.
A cyber-enhanced guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... Yeah, sorry, so there's just a shark jumping that we're through here. It's just...
Well, that's the thing about this. Look. To say this movie, look, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's definitely in the wheelhouse of a big, silly action film. I was entertained, but it is funny that it is, you know... It's kind of similar to a Marvel movie, basically. These characters are no longer human. They do things that only superheroes can do, and they seem to survive scrapes that would really fell mortal beings. So it is really ridiculous, but there's a lot of fun to be had if this is your type of movie. It's interesting in the kind of the third act. The climax takes place in Samoa and really pays tribute to The Rock or the Dwayne Johnson's kind of Samoan background. And we also get the great New Zealand actor Cliff Curtis showing up as his brother. And I wish more time was spent there. This is definitely a movie that doesn't, you know, it moves along. It globe trots. It works in a lot of cameos, which I won't spoil. And on the whole is, you know, it's a $200 million movie designed to make everyone go see it. And look, I had fun. But at the same time, there was something a little bit, you know, you mentioned jumping the shark. It's not as maybe memorable to me as the Fast and the Furious movies, which, you know, had to work in Vin Diesel's ego, had to work in all these cast members. Whereas this, I don't know, the rivalry between Statham and Johnson is good. But on the whole, you know, this is also building up a new universe. There's a shadowy organization that will probably get more investigated in the sequel. So, yeah, this movie is pretty similar to a Marvel movie, and that's all kind of setting up a new franchise.
And we know there's more movies coming because they've already announced, like, the next three.
Yeah. So there's a Furious 9 or whatever is in the works. It's interesting because a lot of this is based on some of the onset tension that came about between Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel, who I think started to take a dislike to each other and various shots fired on social media. So I think Dwayne Johnson's happier not working with Vin Diesel.
Give them their own little branch of the tree.
Yeah, that's it. So look, this film, it's over the top. It's ridiculous. I liked it. It was fun. But yeah, it's a bit like a big... I don't know. There's something about it that could use a little bit more substance, but that's, you know, saying a lot. Yeah.
Are they one of the great screen duos?
I don't know if I'd say great. Good. They you know,
they're Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah, Hobbs and Shaw. I don't know if they get up there with
Sooty and Sweep.
That's it. Tango and Cash. Milo and Otis. I don't know if they
and Yoko.
That's it. We'll see. The box office will definitely tell the story if this duo has what it takes to make another film.
I'd like to know what you feel as far as the responsibilities of representing mankind on this trip.
That's relatively difficult to answer. It's a job that we collectively said that was possible and we could do. And of course, the nation itself is backing us. So we just sincerely hope that we measure up to that.
Apollo 11, a new documentary that debuted in the States earlier this year and just received, you know, rapturous, unanimous acclaim. There have been plenty of films and documentaries about the space program of the 1960s and 70s. You know, we've seen, even in the last couple of years, movies like First Man, starring Ryan Gosling, Hidden Figures, of course. There's, you know, going back further, The Right Stuff, Apollo 13, and who could forget the telemovie Apollo 11, starring Family Law's Kathleen Quinlan. And I know it may be difficult to scrape that version of Apollo 11 from our collective memory, Tristan, but this new Apollo 11, I think, really does take the cake. It has the form of one of my favorite types of genre of documentary filmmaking, which is the archival footage only documentary. The masterpiece of the genre has been Asif Kapadia's Senna from 2011, which is such a masterful movie. He would go on to make Amy and the upcoming Diego Maradona in similar styles. And I didn't watch it this week. Unfortunately, I couldn't get to it. But The Final Quarter, the Adam Goods movie that aired on Channel 10 on Thursday night, I believe, is also archival footage only. But what this new version of Apollo 11 does, and it's directed by Todd Douglas Miller, is compile all this incredible footage from the Kennedy Space Center, from Apollo 11, and just restores it to this pristine fashion. And it has been filmed in such a way, and certainly edited together in such a way, that it is almost indistinguishable from a Hollywood movie. Partly because the Hollywood movies that followed kind of mimicked that style, but it is such an incredible insight into the tick-tock of the launch and ultimately the landing. And it really does have a very narrow scope. It begins about 3 hours before takeoff. We don't learn much about Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, the three men who would go to the moon, except for very brief photo montages. We just see them nervously getting dressed, effectively. And then we see them board, and then we see the countdown to takeoff. And then ultimately, you're watching as they are traveling, and then as the Kennedy Space Center is watching from Houston, of these different stages of this incredible journey to get to totally uncharted territory. And in that way, it kind of becomes, you know, yeah, a procedural. How do you do this? How do you do this incredible task? And then a survival movie. How did they pull it off? And how will they get home? I mean, spoiler alert, you know. But you do kind of get sucked into the world of this this narrative. And it's all done in 90 minutes. There's no external kind of commentary, really. There's no, political framework to it. There's no additional context added except for here is how man got to the moon. And it is such a thrilling and engrossing watch that even in 2019, when you know what follows, you know, when you think of, you know, the Challenger explosion, and I know that's what a lot of people kind of picture when you see a rocket taking off, for instance, or you think about Donald Trump announcing Space Force, or you know what becomes of Richard Nixon, who was president at the time, and he makes a speech or he makes a phone call to Neil Armstrong. The fact that you can kind of get lost again in this moment of 1969 and the way it's edited together, you can still be moved and inspired by it and even have a tear drawn. I think it is such an incredible task of filmmaking. And one of the pleasures comes at the end of the movie when it lists the cinematographers and what names are there, but Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, because they are the ones holding the camera in space. Now, Tristan, I know you haven't seen this, but I do know that you've always said that the moon landing was faked by the lamestream media. Can you comment on that?
Well, look, whoa, you know, I'm, you know, is Stanley Kubrick mentioned anywhere as a director here? Look, yeah, it is. You know, that conspiracy and the kind of its continuation, it is, I mean, yeah, I was kind of thinking about it when I saw First Man. Like, you grow up at a certain point and you just, like, accept it as, like, a fact. Oh, yeah, you know, we went to the moon and people went up there. And then, like, you kind of get removed and it just becomes this iconic image in your head, but not actually thinking about the the intense, like, preparation, training, and then also just, like, the belief and faith in, like, well, this machine will hold up under this pressure to a space that we've not been to before. And so it is, you know, quite incredible, you know, even as a big, you know, chunk of money is thrown towards this you know, technical achievement. And this documentary sounds, you know, fascinating. And I do, yeah, the archival mode is a great way of just kind of like dropping yourself into history without that feeling like, oh no, here comes Dave Grohl again to do a talking head, or, you know, the kind of... Sometimes that is such a, I don't know, a base level generic form of documentary when, you know, you throw in just like famous people to talk about things that everyone knows. So, yeah, I really, this sounds great.
And Taylor, what about you? I mean, all of us here, the moon landing took place well before we were born. Mm. And obviously there will be people going to this movie with memories of when they watched it on TV. But for those of us who did grow up and it was just like an ingrained part of culture, have you been intrigued by, you know, with this week in particular, were you, have you been interested in kind of looking back?
Totally. I think the thing that really got me, and I was speaking to Matt, who shoots Slightly Oddway for us, there's all of this unseen footage before. And his standpoint, which I kind of adopted as my own as well, is people who deny that this happened or who disbelieve, there's a reason that this footage wasn't released when naysayers were naysayers then, and it's super important that it's been released now. Also, just like the logistical, how do you do stuff in space is like what really gets me, and I want to know that. And
yeah.
It's like you mentioned in the credits, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong are listed there with their cinematography. And so I'd like to see, yeah, from their standpoint.
It's
really cool.
It's really cool. It is truly just such a fascinating thing. And yeah, when you watch all the many hundreds, thousands of people who had to put this thing together, when you see this rocket take off, I think it's really important to go back to the mechanics of it and the engineering feat of it all. And then when you see the reality of it, I think that actually makes it even more unbelievable. And I think that's really appreciated.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.